This is Timothy Leary, autobiographer and cheerleader for change.
Aha, okay. Cheerleader for change seems to be a theme I'd like to come back to. But first, if you could tell us a little bit about why you decided to write an autobiography. What led you to that?
Well, I have written 24 books in my long lifetime, and I've written dozens of articles, scores of articles. But they've all been specialized, they've been scientific, scholarly, or I've been talking to the already converted. And my publisher, J.P. Tarcher, came to me and said it was my obligation to write a book that could be read by people that didn't know much about me or about my topic, people that would be seriously and genuinely interested in what went on in the 1960s. This is the first definitive history of the 60s. It's not the only one, there'll be many others, but I think this is the first book to take that tumultuous decade and step by step, event by event. I also have had adventurous, exciting, almost at times melodramatic encounters with some of the top figures in the Cultural Revolution in the 60s, so I describe these events in flashbacks.
You were saying about some of the famous and infamous people you've dealt with over the past years. Is anybody going to get in trouble?
No, this is a good book in the sense it's a good-natured book. I was not out to expose or to show the seamy side. Now, if I'd wanted to write a scandal-ridden expose, we all have experiences and things we've done in the past that we probably wouldn't do again, or we got carried away. I try to present everyone in their heroic mode, with warts and with enough so that the real humanity comes through. But I have some memorable epic adventures with John and Yoko when they were in Montreal, and he wrote the theme song for my governor's campaign when I was running against Ronald Reagan. And how did that happen?
Yeah. Running for governor against Ronald Reagan.
When I was running for governor of California against Ronald Reagan back in 1970, I was going to pick up again. You're talking about will people like the book? Yeah.
I was asking if anybody would get in trouble. I'm wondering.
No, there's nothing in this book that is going to get anyone in trouble. Maybe with their wives in the case of G. Gordon Liddy, but. All the crimes of omission and commission have long passed, and no one's going to... I think it's hard when you write an autobiography because you're writing about people that are still alive. And sometimes, in many cases, this is going to be the main way they will be remembered in history. And I try to be sensitive to people's concern about themselves. For example, there was one friend, and I said he was middle size. Well, I got back a scorching letter in which he said, I prefer to be remembered as slim and tall. Well, what can you do?
Now, you've mentioned the phrase cheerleader for change. I was thinking about this last night. How do you suppose the world would be different without you, if you hadn't been here?
I don't think the world would be different at all. I'm a total believer in evolution. I think that we've been going through an accelerated period of human evolution, both individual and species, in the last, since World War II, certainly, since Hiroshima. There would have been a consciousness movement, there would have been a big counterculture, there would have been a drug movement in the 1960s, no matter who or what had been out there on the sidelines whooping up and cheerleading for it. My notoriety comes from the fact that I was seen, yesterday or a few days ago on Today Show. It's a national show. NBC trotted out their anti-drug doctor. He's on a retainer. And he said that I was charming and intelligent, therefore extremely dangerous because I made drug-taking respectable and therefore led to 5 million young people being destroyed. And I said, hold on, I mean, really, number one, I'm not about drugs. I have nothing to do with most drugs or chemical compounds that you think of as drugs. I have nothing to do with heroin, cocaine, PCP, downers, valiums that are so beloved by the American middle class. personally and in my research, I've been involved with just one class of drugs, the so-called psychedelic drugs, marijuana, mescaline, LSD, peyote, and when used thoughtfully and planfully in a project of self-discovery and change. And as far as people being hurt, the drugs that I've been involved in are obviously the healthiest and the least dangerous. No one ever died of a marijuana overdose that I ever heard of. So that, but no matter what I did or said, this evolution in consciousness and this surge, youthful surge in intelligence was going to happen, and I'm just happy to be around to have surfed that wave.
Where are we in that evolution today, in 1983?
My book is mainly about the baby boom generation, those born between the years 1946 and 1964. 76 million of you. That's twice as many as we expected. 40 million more young people, more mouths, more minds, more lives than we had counted on. And the history of the last part of the 20th century is going to be the history of this enormous group slowly moving into the central stage and taking over. Now, in the 60s, the baby boomers were young. They couldn't vote. So we had a motto then, turn on, tune in, and drop out, because that's all a young person could do. And by drop out, we did not mean, you know, get high and listen to Beatles albums. By drop out, we mean change. Drop out of dropping out. Every day you wake up and you say, where was I? Well, let's drop out of that. Let's keep moving on. But now you ask, where are they going? In the year 1988, the baby boomers, 76 million strong, will be between the ages of 24 and 42. Just think about that. You've got the country in the palm of your loving hands. And the motto now becomes, turn on, tune in, and please take charge and change things. And I don't want to be age chauvinist here. Obviously, I'm a little bit older than 36 myself. I belong to an older generation. So we can amend the motto about don't trust anyone born before 1946. We can change it and say, don't trust anyone who hasn't changed their mind since 1946. And
Well, now that's another question. I know if I spoke to my parents about you, they excuse me, they probably wouldn't know who you are. I know last night I said to my 14-year-old, you know who's coming here tomorrow? And after I told him, he said, who's that? So, now you mentioned the people born between 46 and 64. He was born in 68. So
yeah.
I missed that. But, do you feel that you've been misplaced in your generation?
What do you mean, misplaced?
Do you feel that you somehow accidentally grew up in the wrong generation?
Well, no. I have a diagram in flashbacks which shows the four generations who are now operating in America. And they're like four schools of fish, or four swarms of bees, or four herds moving through space-time. And I jump back and forth. I think I'm in a wonderful position. I can sit down and talk about Benny Goodman with someone my own age. I can talk about Frank Sinatra. I can talk about Elvis with someone who came up in the 50s. I certainly have, and in my book I talk about Jimi Hendrix and the Beatles and the Grateful Dead and the Moody Blues. And I've got a 9-year-old son, and I've got a 10-year-old and 11-year-old grandchildren, and they take me down to the video arcade, and they're my gurus for the new generation, who've never heard of me, but they've heard of Steven Spielberg. And they've heard of E.T., and they love that 14-year-old guy in War Games who stops World War III with his intelligence. So I jump from generation to generation. I try to tune into all of them. That's the only intelligent thing to do.
For my son's generation, for those who were born after 64, what recommendations do you make to maintain that posture of change?
Just don't get trapped by the old guys. Just don't get scared. Make it new. They're an extraordinary generation. I think the baby boomers are a heroic generation, but they're a transition. Kids born after 1964, that's the first generation that was ever conceived consciously. Before that, there was no pill. And people kind of bred automatically, almost like animals or wild creatures. There wasn't that intelligent, planful selection over whether you were going to have a child or not. But your generation, as baby boomers, had to make the decision, do we want to have a baby or postpone it for that trip around the world? Or do we want to have a baby or do you want to go back to law school? You're the first generation, the baby boomers, who could decide when, where, and why they wanted kids. That means that the new kids, the whiz kids, you know, those under 18 right now, are the first generation that have really been wanted and selected. So, and they're the first, you know, computer generation. My 9-year-old son is teaching me how to use a computer, and I think that's incredible. E.T., you know, they banned E.T. In Scandinavia because it glorifies young people and it kind of makes fun of old people. I think, right on, that's great.
Sometimes I wonder if my son's generation will, in its own way, do with computers what my generation did with drugs. I don't know if that's totally off base, but perhaps you'd like to comment.
I'm totally with you. I've often said that personal computers have done for the individual what personal drug use does for the individual in the 60s. Before I went to Harvard and started my drug research, I was very anti-drugs. I didn't like psychiatrists using drugs to get more control over people. You remember we had when a doctor prescribed a drug, he was doing something to a passive patient. I was actually anti-drug until I realized that individuals could get smart enough and learn how to run their own nervous system. And the same thing is true with computers. I was always anti-computer when I thought that computers were multi-million dollar mainframes owned by IBM or CIA or the government to control our lives. It wasn't until Jobs and Wozniak, those brilliant former hippie acid heads themselves, in their own garage in Silicon Valley in California, invented the Apple computer. And that meant that any, you know, 12, 14-year-old kid could have in his or her own bedroom or home the world at their fingertips. The personal computer is a tremendous liberating instrument. And the only way to make sure that Big Brother and his monstrous computers in the FBI, Bureau of Social Welfare, etc., the only way to make sure that these monstrous state-run computers don't control our lives is to be smarter than the computer and know how to outwit it. And that's, of course, why I'm raving these days about the movie Night War Games. I've seen that movie 2 times. I'm going to see it 22 times because it's almost like a Bible for how young people can avoid being co-opted and pushed around by the impersonal system.
At what point is a person responsible enough to control his or her own drug use?
Well, I think that's the first thing we got to tell our kids. You remember, Western civilization, Western religion, Western philosophy is always saying, original sin, you're too dumb to do it yourself. You got to get down on your knees and let God do it for you. The very notion of taking over your life on your own has been out of fashion recently. That's what we resurrected in the 1960s. Of course, I think that everything that I did and that we did in the 60s, along the lines of individual self-development, is the original, basic American tradition. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, look within, be self-reliant. Huckleberry Finn said, Aunt Polly ain't going to civilize with an S, ain't going to civilize me. I'm going to slide down the window and the drain pipe and the lightning rod, and I'm going to head west for the frontier, for the territories where the action is. So this notion of self-development, taking your charge yourself, of video games, hands-on, you can make the tube change instead of just passively watching television. It's the American tinkering, you know-how that we're getting back to in the electronic age, and I'm doing everything in my power in my book and in these talks and lectures to encourage young people to think for yourself and do it yourself.
I want to go back to the NBC doctor and his accusation put it that way. What responsibility do you claim for whoever might have said, Timothy Leary says it's okay?
Well, yes, it's been a source of tremendous concern to me that my name has been associated with a concept of take any drug you want, no matter why. Number one, you know, so people are popping PCP or they're running around shooting up heroin and saying, well, Timothy Leary, Uncle Tim said we should do it. Now, I deplore this. In flashbacks, I have about 4 or 5 pages pages dedicated to testimony I gave in the Senate, I think it was 1966, with Teddy Kennedy, in which I urged government control, government licensing, government education programs, government training programs to teach people how to use the good drugs and to avoid the bad drugs. Of course, there really are no good or bad drugs. Even heroin is good if it's used by a doctor in case of severe pain. But another thing that the government has done, which is malicious, and it's deliberately and planfully malevolent, they lump all drugs together. They say, and Nancy Reagan does this all the time, she says, marijuana is as bad as heroin. Now, that's a disastrously dangerous thing to say, because number one, it's not true. Number two, it's encouraging people to use heroin, because if they try marijuana and see it's all right, they'll be led to take the stronger drug. In many cases, Nancy Reagan says, marijuana is worse than heroin because it leads you to heroin and so forth. Well, misinformation, disinformation, deliberate lying, deliberate exaggeration of casualties, a confusion of the scientific fact that there's an enormous spectrum of drugs, caffeine, nicotine, of course, alcohol, booze is the number one killer, but of course, booze is what they use in the White House, and so we can't knock that. So I've had to deal with this enormous campaign of systematic disinformation. I've just tried to give you some examples of what the government does, and it ends up with my being labeled as the drug doctor, or I'm the one who, with my charm and intelligence, is giving respectability to drugs. And as I said over network television, look, I have nothing to do with heroin. Stay away from PCV, and don't blame me if you use cocaine, because it's going to shrink the membranes of your nose and the membranes of your wallet. I feel badly about my image, and all I can do is what I've done in my book Flashbacks and what I'm doing in this program today to try to tell the truth. And, you know, 90% of the people listening to this program know what I'm saying is right. Unfortunately, Nancy Reagan's not listening. They don't want to hear what I'm saying. And there is this tremendous polarity in America between, and it's age. You know that people over the age of 50, 90% of them are against all drugs, against, say, marijuana, but they're also against computers. There was a Gallup poll in which 90% of people over the age of 50, quote unquote, don't like computers. Now, I don't see how you can not like a computer or dislike. It's not a question of, you know, a computer is not like an aesthetic event that you like or don't like. But what it is they don't want change. They want things to go back the way they were when Ron and Nancy were in the 30s and the 40s, and America was a quiet little country. Whereas people under the age of 30, 66% of them think that marijuana should be legalized, and more than 60% of them like computers. So there's that terrible age difference. And as I said in the back of Flashbacks, I have this diagram. You can locate yourself in that diagram. You can see what your generation shares and how you're different from the other generations. And time is on our side, because the old guard will be gone pretty soon, and the whiz kids and the baby boom generation will take over, and they think differently, and they're nicer people.
There are things that people say you cannot discuss. I remember, you know, myself certain instances where back to the 60s talking about the war and stuff, and if somebody was against it or somebody was for it, you couldn't put the two in the same room. They'd never come to any kind of compromise or agreement or anything like that. Do you think that that it is possible to break that barrier and get through with truth and information, or is it just a matter of let's keep changing and eventually it will evolve?
Yes.
Just evolution, in other words.
In a way, that makes what I do futile. We knew in the 60s, we knew in the 70s, and I know right this minute, talking on the radio to you, that the major decisions you make in your life about your sexual activities, about your recreational activities, about your spiritual activities, about your drug-taking activities, you're not basically influenced by a book, even though my book is wonderful, or by Nancy Reagan, who's coming on a TV show. You're influenced by the people that are close to you, your lover, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your pals, the people in the neighborhood. It's word of mouth. And the great sexual revolution that has occurred in this country, which has freed people to kind of find themselves and be loyal to their inner destiny, and the use of drugs, these decisions are made quietly. They're made, people really trust each other. And that's what I've always said. Don't trust me. Don't trust Nancy Reagan. Don't, you know, trust your friends and never take a drug from or with someone that you don't really know and trust, because you're operating blindly and foolishly. And certainly, there's no one in America that is more against drug abuse than I am. There's no one that has spoken out as forcibly as I am right this minute against the thoughtless, careless abuse of drugs than I. Why? Well, number one, selfishly, if you abuse drugs, I'm going to get blamed for it, and I don't like that. And number two, as a scientist and as someone who specializes in this field, it's my duty to distinguish between the various drugs and to tell people don't ever use a drug unless you know where it comes from, why you're using it, as part of a life plan that makes sense, and without people around to protect you and kind of do a ground control for you in case you need help. And with these obvious common sense rules, you're going to live and grow, and that's what I want for myself and for everyone that's listening to this program.
Would you say that's the primary message here? Or what do you say is the primary message here?
Well, Flashbacks is an autobiography. I start not on the day of my birth, but on the night of my conception as a young, ambitious sperm looking for my mother's egg. And it goes through 62 years. Flashbacks centers on the years 1960, when I went to Harvard and started the drug project, to 1976, when I got out of prison, when the Nixon Ford administration ended. And I think it's the first definitive history of the 1960s. And I think I said that before, but I'll repeat it here. I've also built into Flashbacks small biographical sections at the beginning of each chapter of famous people, famous philosophers or writers or scientists, that have either appeared in that chapter as a personage that I had face-to-face contact with, or whose influence over the years appears in that chapter, like Dante, or like Ralph Waldo Emerson, or like Mark Twain, to remind the reader that the history of individualism and of change that I represent and that I talk about in my autobiography has been going on for centuries. It's the basic American tradition. It's the Athenian tradition of Socrates, go within, know yourself. I'm trying to remind myself and my the readers of Flashbacks that we're part of a long tradition of hopeful, utopian, romantic, self-discovery, frontier thinking, novelty, innovation, change. And there are a lot of forces in the land today that are trying to scare us and make us feel pessimistic, make us feel paranoid, make us forget the American ideals that we're supposed to be the peace-loving future model for the rest of the world. So I put a lot of work into this book because it's the first time I've tried to talk to a broad audience. The book has been reviewed as though it does read like a detective novel. The adventures, the B-movie adventures at times seem so incredulous. It sounds like James Bond. So in the back of the book I have footnotes in the back in which I document. I've had about 20 CIA documents which describe how the CIA followed me and set me up and even paid my way out of Algeria to get me to a place where they could arrest me. So the espionage adventure parts of the books, they are true, and I think they'll keep the reader moving through a book which is not just adventure but also deeply philosophic. I know that a lot of this will rub off on the reader.
I know Phoebe's going to want to pull you out of here in about 2 minutes. Before that, is there anything else that you would like to say? The audience that we're aiming for here in the room is basically the target demo is 16 to 22.
Well, and in Flashbacks, I describe the many encounters I had with some of the great rock musicians of the 60s, because as we all know, the message of the 60s, which is going to blossom out in the 80s, was carried on by musicians. John Lennon wrote my campaign song, Come Together, which later became a hit. Jimi Hendrix played bass guitar on an album which was made for my governor's campaign. I described the visits and hanging out with the Moody Blues, who wrote that famous song, Legend of a Mind. Timothy Leary's dead, no, he's on the outside looking in. There's a new San Francisco punk new wave group which got a song called Timothy Leary Lives, in which they're kind of making fun of the Moody Blues. So I give great credit to the musicians and minstrels and rock and rollers of that period who contributed so much to the cultural changes that have liberated us all.
Let me ask you one more question. Do you have any predictions for 1988 when the 46 to 64ers have the world in the palm of our hands?
Yeah, I think that when the young people take over, they're going to cut out partisan politics. You can't run a country like America, which is an incredible spaceship. It's like a big 747 up there, in which two pilots are fighting it out in the front of the cabin, who's going to be in control, and then the guy that loses, you throw him in the back. You simply can't run a modern government in the information technological age with that gladiator fighting of Democrats and Republicans. We're going to have a more civilized, cooperative, collaborative way in which we all work together as Americans. And anything that divides Americans is I think, disastrous. We've got to somehow... See, Ronald Reagan is a fighter, and he really sincerely believes that people that don't agree with him are wrong. He's got the Bible on his side. He's got the flag on his side. This is the old-time philosophy of politics that's got to end. And we're all Americans, and all Americans, we're on a team together. We made quarrel over who should be quarterback, but, the divisiveness and the partisanship on drugs. America cannot be healed unless this terrible gulf between the generations on the use of drugs, that's a symptom, until this terrible conflict, the older generation simply will not accept the fact that the music, the drugs, the lifestyle, the individuality that the young people feel is part of the mainstream. The old ones want their own drug booze, they want their own way of life preserved, and they got to give in. So I know that the young people, when they take over, will institute a period of reconciliation and healing and compassion and brother and sisterhood, because that's what America's all about.
All right. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. A little sermon at the end there. Now, if you'll kneel down, I'll bless you all. Leave your contributions in the collecting plate as you leave.